This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In the aftermath of the murder of three people and the death of the shooter on September the 6th at the Fifth Third Center on Fountain Square, the bank and the community responded. The desire was to support the families of those killed, the survivors and their families, and employees who were impacted by the events that day. One result was the creation of Cincinnati Strong Victims Fund. How to use the substantial funds that were collected is now before the committee that was formed to manage the fund. We are joined now by the chair of the steering committee of the Cincinnati Strong Victims Fund, Kristen Weavers. Ms. Weavers is the senior vice president and chief marketing and communications officer for UC Health, the director of Trauma Recovery Center at the Cincinnati Veterans Administration Medical Center, and professor of psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience at the University of Cincinnati, Dr. Kathleen Chard, and the deputy executive director of the National Center for Victims of Crime and the director of the National Crime Victim Bar Association, Jeff Dion. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everyone, to Cincinnati Edition. It's good to have all of you here. Kate Chard, let's start. In a situation like the one at the Fifth Third Center, how does trauma manifest itself first? Let's just, what do we mean by trauma in this situation?
Well, I think it can be a variety of things. So it can be just having some sleepless nights and nightmares after the event. It could be maybe even fear of going downtown, fear of going into a bank. But it can get much worse than that. So it can actually get to the point where the person's having problems functioning at all, feeling unsafe, especially in a crowd or in an open area where there are a lot of people. And I think that's what we're trying to let people know about today, is that if it's getting to the point where you can't go to work or you're having problems taking the kids even to somewhere like the zoo, then maybe it's time to go in and get help.
Okay. And how far in a family or with a group of people, how far can there be ripples effects of trauma? So there could be the people who had a loved one who was shot or who was in that lobby. But, you know, is it just the immediate family? Is it, does it ripple out to friends? How far can this really go?
Unfortunately, it can go quite a bit further. And the worst, as you mentioned, is the children. Because not only do the children see their parent saying, we can't go out somewhere because it's unsafe, and now the child just gleans that idea and is now running with it. But also sometimes the parents become more anxious. They start looking over their shoulder, doing more checking, maybe become more irritable. So the sad tragedy is that when a parent actually has a big traumatic stress response, children often begin to suffer not only in their social ways, but also school, irritability, even connecting with peers. So it is pretty significant.
Jeff Dion, you represent a national organization, the National Center for the Victims of Crime. First off, what is that?
The National Center for Victims of Crime is the nation's leading resource and advocacy organization serving victims of all types of crime. We've been around since 1985. And starting in 2014, we created the National Compassion Fund at the request of survivors of the Aurora Theater shooting to help address this issue of the collection and distribution of charitable contributions of following mass casualty crimes, trying to create a process that was victim-centered and trauma-informed to make things easier for victims of mass casualty crimes, and also to give some confidence to donors so that they know that where they're donating their money is going to a trusted organization and it's going to go to those people directly impacted by it. And that's why we make sure that 100% of the money that's donated for victims is distributed to victims of that particular crime.
So what have you learned from other communities that could be helpful in a place like Cincinnati once something like this takes place, so that, you know, here you are, a national organization, what can you come in and tell the steering committee, for example, here's what we've learned from this experience or that experience?
One of the things that we've learned that we share with these local steering committees is setting the it's a delicate balance in how you set the timetable. We know that the longer the fund is kept open for donations, the more money will come in, and you want to keep it open long enough for corporations to contribute. They tend to donate more, but they tend to donate slower than individuals. So we want to make sure we keep the fund open long enough to accommodate those contributions for the benefit of victims, but also close the fund early enough so that we can get help to victims in a timely manner when they need it. Because we give away 100% of those donations, in order for us to figure out how much the benefit's going to be for each category, we have to know how much money's been donated and how many validated victims do we have in each of those categories. And so it's trying to make sure we get it just right. And so understanding that is part of what we help communities with. Also, understanding that sometimes when you give victims, everyone wants to say, I'm going to help cover this. And for instance, after the Las Vegas shooting, there was a shoe company that said, we're going to pay for everyone's funerals. Well, the problem was that funerals are already covered by state crime victim compensation programs, and if you get money from someplace else, then all of a sudden victims are faced having to give that money back to the state, and it creates problems. So we help them understand what are the other available resources and benefits available to victims so that we don't duplicate efforts and create any administrative nightmares for victims. We want to make this as easy and as helpful as possible.
Kristen Weavers, you're the chair of the steering committee, and that steering committee is relatively large. You can mention that a little bit. But what have you learned so far from working with Jeff Dion from the national perspective or Kate Chard on a local level? What is this committee, because these are people who have lots of different backgrounds, what have you learned that's helped you take the first steps in figuring out what to do?
Thanks, Dan. I think the most insightful learning that we've had is how much this community cares about each other and that we really have come together to try and make sure that things like this don't happen. And if they do, how do we respond? And Jeff has provided that framework to understand that we can make a difference for people and help the response of so many who are giving. Fifth Third led the first contribution to this fund, and many others are continuing. What we're charged with doing is coming together as a community to make sure that victims are recognized and that they do have support and help from this community, and that support and help continues beyond the very tragic tragedy of that day on September 6th.
My understanding is that you're still in the process of figuring out how to use these substantial funds that have been raised. Is that correct?
Well, we've actually finalized the protocols and they are posted online, and we have opened the time frame for victims to understand that this is available for them. This is a pure gift to them to use in the manner that will help them recover the way that is best for them. It is purely a gift. The protocols have been finalized by this committee of really incredibly compassionate community members such as Stephanie Bird from the American Red Cross and Julie Calvert from the Cincinnati Convention and Visitors Bureau, and certainly Teresa Tanner at Fifth Third and Heidi Jark have been very compassionate and engaged leaders for us on this committee. There are many more. Dr. Chard is part of the committee as well, and I think they did a great job of putting a diverse group of community leaders together. We had discussions about the protocol with Jeff's help in helping to guide us. Those are finalized, posted. And now we're hoping that the fund grows and that we work through ensuring people are aware that they can really access the fund, those people who were victims.
Dr. Chard, or I guess this could be Jeff too, but let's start with Dr. Chard. Do people who have been victims of this, either because they're survivors, but they were in the midst, maybe physically injured, maybe psychologically traumatized, or families of people who died or whatever, how do people even know what to ask for? I mean, that's so that they're asking for the right thing, not in the sense of what somebody else wants them to do, but so that they understand what they need to do. I mean, I don't know that that's obvious until you're in the middle of this a situation like this. You haven't thought this through about what I'm going to need.
You're exactly right, Dan. And I think that's the key thing is so many people have never thought about what would I do if something happened, if there was a fire in my home or if there was a shooting. We just can't fathom that kind of thing happening to us.
Or don't want to.
Right? And often people worry if I think about it, it'll make it come true instead of the opposite, which is if we plan for it, maybe we'll be able to, you know, prevent or stop it. And obviously in this situation, there was nothing that we could do to prevent this from happening. And so now it's about identifying what do I need. And just like our soldiers, we often don't think to ask for help. We think we're supposed to be stronger. We think we're supposed to just, you know, buckle down and get through it. Or maybe even that money is better for somebody else. This isn't really affecting me that much. So let's just save all that for somebody else. And I think that's the humility of the human spirit. But also, we have to remember to look out for ourselves, because what if this is something that's going to affect us long term or begin giving us problems later? And it does affect our employment, or it does affect, you know, our ability to take care of our children. I think what we need to consider at this point is reaching out, talking to a therapist. Am I having problems? Should I at least get screened for this? We do provide, of course, the free services at the UC Health Stress Center for that. And I think it's really important that everyone take stock. Am I the same person I was when I woke up that morning? Or has anything in my life changed? And if the answer is something has changed, then it may be worthwhile just talking to someone to see if it would be good to apply for services. It doesn't hurt to apply.
Jeff Dionne, is given what Dr. Chard just sort of laid out, there can be sort of the mix between the immediate impact and the long-range impact. And is that the sort of thing that the protocols that you've helped lay out help people, the protocols actually help people get guided to the right thing?
Well, I think Dr. Chard was absolutely correct that people can't predict what their needs are going to be, and they've never been through this before, and they're not sure what they're going to face. And all we can do is distribute all of the money that's donated. And so by making sure that we give that out in a fair and transparent manner, people can then take whatever benefits they receive, and then they're empowered to think about what's going to work for them. We don't want to dictate to them about what they should do with the money. They can do whatever they want, and they can look at what's going to make a difference in my life, what's going to help me get through this, whether it is paying the rent for 6 months or getting themselves more mental health treatment or putting it aside for the future for those unknowns that pop up. And so we think individuals are best equipped to determine what their needs are. And so we put a plan in place that lets them make that decision and empowers them to do that.
Dr. Chard, this might have been even better if I'd asked this question last week, but we weren't together. But at this time of the year, lots of families are together. And in some cases, it may have pulled people together who haven't been together since an incident like this incident. And if you're not one of the people affected, but you know one of the people affected, what should a person, on the one hand, who wants to express their concern, but on the other hand, do you want to just say, what happened that day? And in effect, ask the person to relive it. What's the balance there, and how do people who are relatives or friends be helpful in this situation?
You raise such a great point there, Dan. For many people, the holidays are actually more stressful. The family maybe doesn't provide the Norman Rockwell experience that they were expecting. And so they actually leave feeling more distressed after Thanksgiving or the December holidays than they did going in. And so sometimes friends and family can be absolutely critical at helping with that. And the key is exactly what you said. Do not ask them what happened, because asking them to relive it can be very painful. But the better question is how are you and what can I do for you? And if they want to tell their story, then great. Please listen without judgment. Not, why were you on Fountain Square anyway? Or why do you go out? Or you should carry a weapon? Or all of those types of statements. Those are not helpful. But more, what do you need? Can I go for a walk with you? Would you like to go to see a movie? How about we grab dinner? Or do you just want me to listen to you? And providing listening without judgment is one of the best ways we can help anyone ever recover from any of these types of events.
Jeff Dionne, your organization has been around for some time, 30 years plus, I guess. Has the organization's approach changed over time? Have you refined the way that you do it?
Absolutely, because our understanding of trauma has changed. And I think that we're always looking to improve our response, to have a more victim-centered approach to what we do. And there is a greater understanding and recognition that psychological trauma is not just in someone's head and that it's something they need to get over. Psychological trauma is every bit as real and debilitating as a physical injury. And that's why we make a point of making sure that we include benefits for those people who have been subjected to psychological trauma by an act of mass violence, to validate them and to also get them the help that they need to recover. When going back to the federal government's response to 9/11, in which we assisted, the rules in place at that time said if you did not suffer a physical injury, you were not eligible for any benefits. And I think that was short-sighted. I think we have a better understanding of trauma, and we can provide a better response now.
That's very interesting. Kristen Weavers, who's eligible for this? Who, in your protocols, how would you define that? And Jeff said something about one of the top commitments here is to make sure all of the money collected is distributed. What kind of timeline are you on to get this done? Because I would suspect there are people who need the assistance sooner rather than later.
Thanks, Dan. That's a big question. There's a few questions in there, but good ones nonetheless. So
that's why I ask you.
Thank you. So the protocols are posted on the website that we can reference. Is that correct?
Yep.
So
yep.
It's on our
website. There will be a link.
Okay. And the NationalCompassionFund.org, Cincinnati Strong. And they go through the protocols, which, this is hard to talk about, but those who, you know, families who experienced death in their family, people who had physical injury and actually had to be hospitalized, people who were not hospitalized but also were treated because of physical injury, those witnessing the attack and its aftermath. Those are the areas from which we've written our protocols. And
so witnessing might be the people who were in that lobby or on the square or whatever?
Absolutely correct. And beyond the lobby, who might have been on Fountain Square and experienced this awful tragedy.
What about the police officers?
Unfortunately, I think the understanding is that their jobs prevent us from actually providing money from this fund. But absolutely, I think acknowledging that we have PTSD in our first responders, not just police, but fire and rescue, and being supportive of them as well is absolutely critical.
It's a great point, Dan, because we couldn't have done what we did. And the lives, there could have been many more deaths without the great work of the first responders. And in fact, Fifth Third did host an event to honor and invite them because we all value what they did and what they do every day.
So what's your timeline?
Good question.
That was distribution.
That was the other part of that multi-question question that you posed. So we're coming together. The deadline for submission for the application for benefits is December 10th. The deadline for contributing is November 30th. And we expect to come together as a steering committee in early January to work through the distribution plan and approve that based on the applicants that we receive that come in again by December 10th. It's really hard to put a deadline on this because, and it's part of why we're grateful to be having this conversation so people are aware of it so that they can access it and apply.
I think a logical question here is how much money has been accumulated in the fund?
There has been probably, I believe it's about $1.1 million at this point. It's a bit greater than that. I don't have the latest figure given the holiday, but you know that will be fully distributed to the victims. And again, we want to help as many people as we can.
Well, I want to thank all three of our guests, Kristen Weavers, Dr. Kate Chard, and Jeff Dion, for being with us today. More importantly, of taking this responsibility on in the community. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our programs are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.